All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. And I'll give you a quick heads up and then we'll get started. Calls are starting to come in pretty heavy, but questions are still light. We're going to record either 1 or 2 hours today, depending on how many calls and questions we get. And today is a free-for-all. You can ask questions about anything at all. So here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Website is letstruck.com. Show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your own authority, building a fleet. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call, we'll talk about it on the air. Couple things, and then we're going to get right to your phone calls and see what it is you want to talk about. I am working on a project. Actually, I'm almost done with this project. I haven't mentioned this one really, but I'm almost done with it, but I need your help. So I have a full-blown program helping people get started as an owner-operator. It's got audio, it's got video, it's got workbooks. It's $247. If you are thinking about becoming an owner-operator, it's the best $250 you will spend. It will either talk you out of it, or it will help you to pull the trigger and make the decision and then show you exactly how to do it right step by step. I put a lot of time and effort into that program. It's part of what I've been doing for a very long time. And if you want that program, go get it. It's at the website, letstruck.com. But I get a lot of questions about this topic, people new to the industry, but even veterans keep signing these lease purchase deals, and they don't realize how risky they are and how much money they're losing. And the industry has promoted these as virtually risk-free. Sign here, drive the truck. If you don't like it, you can just walk away. That is not risk-free. People, I've tracked the numbers. People lose $5,000 to $10,000 on one of these deals in lost revenue, lost time, repairs they end up doing to a truck that isn't even theirs. And there's always the risk that even if you were successful at this, the company can take the truck anytime they want. You don't own anything. So I want to help more people understand the issues before they sign the deal. I'm not telling anybody not to sign it. That's your life, your business. I just want you to be informed. So I have written another book about the top 6 mistakes people make when they want to become an owner-operator. There is a lot of information in there about lease purchase, but that's not all of it. It's all the mistakes people make when they go to look for a truck, even if they're going to buy a truck on their own. I point out the mistakes they'll make. I'll point out the mistakes with money and figuring budgets and all those things. The top 6 mistakes that people make. Now, the book, my part of the book is done. It's being edited by Brittany, part of our Let's Truck team here, who is an amazing editor, so I'm glad to be working with her on this. And the hard part for me is done. All the writing is done. She's very good at editing. It's not going to be long. And we're getting ready to roll this project out. We're probably within a couple weeks. We have some technology issues to work on, but this is going to happen fairly quick before the end of the year. Now, I'm looking for stories. So this is where I need your help. I want to include 6 stories. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the 6 mistakes are. I want to include 6 stories that highlight each one of the mistakes. I don't want people writing stories based on the mistake that I would tell them. What I want you to do is I want you to write your horror story, your lease purchase horror story. Doesn't have to be long. I would imagine most of these could be written in about 500 words, 500 to 1,000 words. Don't worry about grammar, editing, punctuation, spelling. You know, make it legible, but don't worry about anything other than get the story across to us. We'll edit it. We'll make it pretty. I say we, that'll be Brittany again. But she'll make all the writing good, spelling, punctuation, all that stuff. So don't worry about that. Get us, you know, 500 to 1,000 words. If it's longer, that's fine. If it's shorter, we'll look at it. And I'll do 2 things for you. One, I'll send you a free pre-trip tool. And 2, I'll list you as a contributing writer on the book. Now, here's the really good news. We are going to give this book away. So when we're done with this project, there is going to be no charge for this book. This is going to be a free ebook. This is my way of giving something back to the industry this year. And, you know, one of the dangers of making something free, and I don't do this a lot because people tend to devalue things that are free. But I really don't want to charge for this. I want people to be able to read this and know what they're getting into and know the biggest mistakes to avoid when they want to become an owner-operator, whether it's looking for a truck, looking for a carrier, deciding on a lease purchase, budget, any of those things. They will be covered. They are covered in this book. I'm going to go one step further. Because I'm always kind of pushing you to listen to more audio because you have all that time on the road. So once the book is edited and we get the stories, then I'm going to create an audio version of the book as well, and the audio version is going to be free. So you're going to get the free ebook and the free audio version, and everybody will. We're just going to make it available to everybody. So send me your lease purchase horror stories, and you'll get, if I choose, I'm going to choose 6. If I can find 6 that fit the mistakes, if not, I may choose 3. You'll get a free pre-trip tool, very cool little tool that goes on your keychain and helps you do some cool things on a pre-trip. And I will list you as a contributing author, and you'll have the satisfaction of knowing you helped me out to give back to the industry. So get your stories written. We don't have a lot of time on this. The sooner the better. And send them. I'm going to give you an email address here, so grab something to write with. Send them to support@letstruck.com. And again, the sooner the better, because as soon as they start rolling in, I'm going to start reading them. I'd love to get 6. 1, I kind of highlight each mistake that I see people make. But or let me expand that. I said lease purchase horror stories. I am looking for those. But if you have another horror story about getting started as an owner-operator, even if it doesn't involve a lease purchase, maybe you bought the wrong truck, didn't, you know, do enough testing on the truck, started with a really lousy carrier, whatever it might be, send me your owner-operator startup horror stories, lease purchase as well. All right. What else? You know what? I think that's good for today. I think I'm going to jump into a phone call. But you know what? We're coming up on the end of the segment. Let me wrap this up. We'll get right to your phone calls when we get back from this first break. It is December, and it feels like December is already blowing right by us. We're into the holidays, not a lot of work getting done. This is the time of year to take advantage of things slowing down. Review your year, what worked for you this year, what didn't work for you this year, and start planning next year. Get it in writing. Get a big picture of what you want to accomplish. Set some short-term goals. When I say short-term, I'm talking about stuff that you can do in 30 days or less. You know, what are your short-term goals going to be? Set some long-term goals. Get stuff in writing. And get your accounting taken care of. If you need somebody to help you with accounting and taxes, we have a program for everybody. If you want us to do all the work, we can. If you want to do the work and use our software, we can help you with that. If you just want us to do the tax return, we can do that. We have got a program for everybody. Give us a call. It's 855-800-FUEL. Make this the year that you actually wrap things up before the year is over with. I would love to start getting phone calls from people who know what their year looks like and they want to do some year-end tax planning before the year's actually over. So get that done. Call me with your questions. You can call our TribeCare team, 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. We're going to get to your calls right after this break. Stick around. I'm Kevin Ruff. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right to some phone calls. Let's start off in Texas. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Kevin. As always, thanks for taking my call. A quick question for you. I'm getting ready here when we get home to put my first month's worth of receipts into profit gauges. And this load that we're going to deliver here tonight, it actually started in November. Now, I'm thinking that when we have a load that carries over and the revenue is not going to register until the next month, I'm thinking I would just count that those miles and those expenses in December when the revenue is coming in. Is that a good way to do it, or is there a better way to look at it?
This is a very common question, and I like to keep things simple. And it's not always completely accurate if we're looking at a month at a time. But the way I like to look at my accounting is I'll look at each month, then I'll look at a quarter, then I'll look at 6 months, and then I'll look at a year. And then I'll look at this year compared to last year. That's why, you know, a good accounting system is a marathon, not a sprint. And the longer we do it, the better we get at it and the better the information gets. So I don't worry too much about trying to get each month perfect with miles and numbers that actually happened in that month. So what I recommend is all I look at when I make entries into my accounting system are dates on documents. So for mileage, I just tell people write down your odometer on the first of every month. So then the next first of every month, you write down your odometer. Again, it's the first. We just subtract this month's number from, or last month's number from this month's number, and we know how many miles we drove in that month. That's how I get the mileage. That's nice and simple. Then when I sit down to enter the documents themselves, I don't even try to think about when did this happen. All I do is use the receipt date or the settlement date. So all settlements are different. Sometimes they give you like the week starting, the week ending, the week they issued it, the day they issued. I don't care which date I use. You just want to be consistent. So sit down with one of your settlements, look at whatever dates are on there and say, okay, here's the date I'm going to use every time I put in a settlement. So now when I sit down, I look at receipts. If they're dated November, they go in November. I look at settlements. If the date that I'm going to use every time says November, it goes in November. It's consistent. It's simple. And the little discrepancies, you're never going to get them right anyway. And they work themselves out the longer we look at numbers.
That makes a lot of sense. And the important thing is just the consistency, which is what I figured.
That,
so that's
that
a lot simpler.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was kind of my thought behind all this, was keep it simple so we don't have to keep rethinking this every time we sit down to do it. And as long as we're consistent, then it's really not going to matter.
Right, and the data becomes more useful the longer, the more data I get in there. Right now, it's,
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sometimes we look at a month. You know, sometimes we look at a month, and no matter how hard we try to get the dates exactly right, they're never going to be. And even if they are, you know, if you have a month where you do a major repair, well, your numbers are all going to be skewed that month. That's where the more you do it, the more you learn how to look at the numbers and say, well, you know, my net profit this month might look really low, but I spent $6,000 on tires. Those tires are going to last me 2 years. So, you know, and sometimes I'll sit down and I'll take a month like that if I really want to know the numbers, and I'll take those tires and I'll say, they are going to last me 2 years, so I'm going to divide this number by 24. And just in my head or on paper. Yeah, so I like to keep the accounting simple, and then if I need to go deeper, it's not that hard to do. Once you understand the accounting and what's going on, you can look and make those adjustments yourself. But by the end of the year, when I'm looking back over the whole year, even a bill like a $6,000 or $7,000 tire bill, that it's more accurate now.
Right, because it averages out over the 12 months. And so your overall average cents per mile on maintenance starts to even out.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Well, awesome. Again, as always, thank you. And I'll leave you to the next one. Take care, Kevin.
You're welcome. And congratulations on getting started right. You are a clear case and example of the outline that I have in my program, doing things step by step, having a plan, and then executing the plan. You're doing your accounting right from the first month. This is going to be a successful venture for you, I am convinced. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Nick, welcome to the program.
Kevin, I want to talk about, instead of the bulletproof coffee for those of us that just can't stomach coffee for whatever reason, I have found, with the help of some of the other people that are doing this, John Reed, for example, smoothies. Take a fresh, good berry, kale, spinach, whatever you like in it, whether you use ice or no ice, some yogurt, things like that, and a simple little $20-$30 blender. Doesn't have to be anything crazy that you see. You can add a few nuts to it if you want. Perfect thing to start the morning. You know, a slice or two of bacon. Wonderful things to have.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I would caution people on, the way you described it is perfect. What you have to be careful of is I've seen smoothies that have more sugar than I would eat in a week in one smoothie. And they're, you know, claimed to be really, really healthy. Well, I don't think so. So that's just the one thing you've got to watch. And I know when there are a couple reasons I don't make smoothies, and that doesn't mean they're bad or I think they're bad or anything else. It's just me. If I do a heavy on the vegetable smoothie, I can do it. For me, I have to add, believe it or not, a lot of heat. So I'll put in, mm-hmm. you know, peppers, ghost peppers, all kinds of crazy hot stuff. And I'll do it more of like a juicing kind of thing rather than a thick smoothie. If I do a smoothie, it's one of the few times where I want it to be sweet. But I don't want it to be sweet. I mean, if I want to like the taste of it, I end up putting in, you know, more fruit than I should or more honey. And so, and the other thing I find with smoothies is I have a hard time making one that's satisfying. I tend to be hungry not long after I have one. That's really individual, though. What you just described is a great way to do this. Like you said, you don't like the coffee. This is a great way to start the day. You can get a lot of nutrition out of it. And if it's satisfying for you, then that's a great idea.
And and the biggest thing is, you know, knowing the glycemic index, which fruits are the stuff you want to stay away from, you know, stay away from your tropicals because they have that natural sugar in so much of it. But there is, you know, and it's kind of a learning process for all of us. The more information, the long term that it goes, the more we will learn, you know, this and that, you know, try this, not that. And it's a very good learning process for all of us, and I have to thank you for what you have done for the industry, not only in just the trucking side, but also the health side, because it does, everything that you try, you give us the information that allows us to try to become better people, not only personally, but, you know, in our health lives as well.
You know, and the beauty of that is then the tribe, people like you, take the idea, work on it, tweak it, try different things, and then feed it back to us. And it's just a great positive loop that I love. I think I learn more from my listeners than I teach, so it's a wonderful thing. You know, one other thing that having a smoothie like that as part of your or a juice drink, something you make, another good reason to do that is if you identify a nutrient that you tend to be deficient in and you're not getting it in your regular diet, maybe it's something you just don't like the food, it's much easier to hide something like that in a smoothie or a drink. So you could say, look,
absolutely,
you know, I really need more potassium, and, you know, but I hate eating kale. I know it's a great source of it, or avocado or whatever. You hide it in the smoothie, and you can still make it taste the way you want, and you can target nutrition that way.
And I do have a question about cold air stuff, if you'd hold me over.
Okay, will do. Great stuff. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website, letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. Before the break, I was talking with Nick in Pennsylvania. Nick, go ahead.
At 50 degrees or above, I lose no air for days on end if the truck sits. Below 50 degrees, I lose air overnight. I have soaked every little fitting and hose I can possibly even get to. is there a dye or anything that I can put into the air system that will help me locate what is causing this?
There are some things. I've looked at them, and I haven't found anything I'm all that impressed with. And you've got the double whammy here. One of the hardest things we have troubleshooting are air leaks. When we had the shop, we spent a lot of time trying to develop better ways to find air leaks. It was how we stumbled on the smoke machine to use for a charger cooler. We had originally bought it hoping we'd be able to test air leaks with it, and it was a horrible failure at that. We had already spent all the money on the machine, so we were sitting around staring at it one day, and we came up with the idea of the charger cooler. So it was a nice discovery by accident. Air leaks are tough to find. You've got the double whammy because you only have a cold air leak. That makes it twice as hard to find. For one thing, you can only go look for it when it's below that temperature when it shows up. Otherwise, you're never going to see it. So it makes it more uncomfortable. You know, you're going to have to be out in the cold trying to find it. I've seen some devices that listen for sound. I've seen some dyes. I haven't seen a whole lot of really good results with them, though. I wish I had a better answer for you, and you know, we can certainly throw it out there and see if somebody has something they really like. But for me, it's always just been pure hard work and sometimes a little luck.
I mean, I've tried anything as pure soap, thinking, you know, say a Dawn detergent, squirting it directly on, you know, not diluting it, hoping for a small bubble. I've tried adding in external air, taking the air pressure to 140 PSI, 150 to see if it's anything like that. And it drives a guy nuts that does real maintenance on his truck to know that there's a problem. It's not audible. It's not DOT going to shut you down, but it's still an issue. To fix it before it comes an issue, and it's absolutely. So it's just a matter of luck of the popping of the hood, and there it is one day.
You know, some of the worst I've found turn out to be so deep behind something that you're not going to find it until it gets really bad. You know, if we get to all the places we can get to, and we listen and we try soap solutions and we do all those things and we can't find it, there's a good chance it's someplace we're not looking. Deep in the dash or, you know, behind the firewall, there's some crazy places, and a lot of times that's what it ends up being. It just ends up being a fitting that isn't easy to get to. Like I say, I wish I had a better answer. We worked on it, never really came up with anything that I was very impressed with.
Okay. I appreciate your time and your help. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to North Dakota. Wally, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How's it going today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was thinking about getting it's a stationary pedal bike. I was told that it would be easy on the joints, and I was thinking about putting it in the truck. And I'm not sure if that was what you thought about that when it comes to cardio, if that would actually help increase cardio.
Here's the thing. Any activity that you will do is good. The biggest reason people don't see results is they don't follow through. They don't keep doing it. So, you know, whether it's impact, low impact, high impact, I think we've kind of overdone, you know, worrying about impact, especially if you've got a good diet and you're fairly healthy, your body can stand up to a lot. I think where we could see some problems is when people go, and honestly, we don't even see a lot of problems in these super endurance athletes as long as they eat right and, you know, train right and those kind of things. The one thing I would have you try, and it works much, much better for me. I have never been a big fan of long cardio sessions. You know, there was a lot of research that says you need a 20-minute warm-up, and then you need at least 20 minutes in your target heart zone, and then you need a cool-down, and it comes to about an hour. For some people, an hour is nothing. For me, an hour of cardio, I hate it. Even if I'm listening to books, reading books, I just don't like to do it. Well, what I found, and there's a lot of research showing there's way more benefit and a lot less time to just doing things with more intensity. You know, what happens with long cardio, and I've known people like this, and if you look around, you can probably find them. People who run marathons, full-blown marathons, who are still struggling with a weight problem. And I look at him and I think, oh, my God, I'm in awe of the fact that you can run 26 miles. And I'm in awe of the fact of how many miles you had to run to get there, all the training. And yet it doesn't seem like it's making you that much healthier. So I really found for me high intensity works much better than long time. And I don't have the issue of saying, well, I don't have, you know, 2.5 hours to go work out today, so I'm going to have to skip it. My high-intensity cardio takes 20 minutes total. The warm-up's only about 2 or 3 minutes. Then it's alternating full out as hard as you can do something, whether it's swimming, running, biking, jump roping, whatever it is. You go, like, all out for 30 seconds, as hard as you can go. And then you kind of coast for 90 seconds, and then you go all out for 30 seconds, and then coast for 90. And you do that like 6 to 8 sets all at once, and it works out to about 20 minutes, and you're done. And the results for me are way better than I ever get from long cardio in a target heart rate. So give that a try. And a stationary bicycle, as long as it's got a resistance to it where you can crank it up, would be ideal for something like this.
Okay, and then I need a book recommendation. I've read books on accounting for numberphobic, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Make Change Work, Shark Tank, Jumpstart Your Business, Dave Ramsey, Total Money Makeover, great book, by the way. Tony Roberts, I've started reading his book, and I realized, you know, it's kind of better off getting a hard book and treating it like a dang textbook from college and start highlighting and marking that one.
It is.
A lot of information. And yeah, there's a lot of information in there. So I'm going to be looking at buying that in a hard copy. And the other two that I finished reading was, it's called Work for a Reason and How to Win Friends and Influence People. So what else do you recommend?
Wow, you've got a great list there. That is an excellent start, because as you were, I had like 6 books in mind, and you just went through all of them in your list. So now I have to rethink.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, you hit some really good ones there.
Well, the two more that I was going to start reading was Steve Jobs Way and the War of Art.
You know, I'm not a big fan of the Jobs book. He was an amazing guy. And clearly, I followed his history from way back when, and then he got kicked out of Apple. And I knew most of his history before I read the book. But honestly, other than what he accomplished, I'm not a big fan of Steve Jobs. He was a little out there, and his methods were way too extreme for anything I would ever want to do. It's an interesting story. I just didn't find a lot of good lessons in there that worked for me. The War of Art, by all means, that is just probably, even though it's not a very big book and it really kind of focuses on one pretty narrow topic, it's one of the most influential books I've read. So, yeah, I would recommend that one. Another good one is a book called Standout. And it talks about, you know, identifying what your strengths are and then shows you how to work in those strengths and how to get around your weaknesses. And those two books together, have had a huge influence on the way I do things and the things I've been able to accomplish. So try those two together. I think you're going to like those a lot. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back with Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour. At the end, I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. But hang on. Well, you know what? Let me look at the number of questions we have here. One, two. We're actually pretty low on questions. Couple more just came in. Let's do this. I'm going to give it 15 seconds. If you've got a question, a comment, something you want to get through with today, press 1 on your phone right now. And if I have enough, we'll go into a second hour. If not, we're going to wrap this up. So I'm counting down right now. We'll go to 15 seconds. And we're good. All right, you could still press 1. I might still be able to get to you, but I think we're good to do another hour, so here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. We're going to head off to Georgia. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I have a truck. I rebuilt the engine, and I did regular oil for 7,000. I put synthetic in it, and then I did an oil change. And you have the report there, I believe.
Yeah, I do. Let's take a look here. So this is an N14, about just under 30,000 since the end frame and 20,000 on this oil. And this looks really good. Couple things here that tell us the engine's running good. We've got low fuel dilution, fairly low soot. And I don't get to, you know, on an N14, I kind of treat that like a pre-emission cat or a Series 60. The lower the soot, the better. Not that this level of soot would hurt anything, but I like to really, really drill down and get the engine running the best it can run. And one indication of that is soot. You're at 0.9. Again, nowhere near anything to worry about. On these types of engines, I'd like to get it down to 0.1 or less. Then we know everything's running right. Sometimes it takes some modifications, muffler, fleet air filter, fast, some other things really help us tweak that. But I don't worried about it until we do overhead reset.
Okay, I have the fast fuel system, I have the fleet air filter, I have the OPS, I have Pittsburgh power muffler, Pittsburgh ported manifold, camshaft balancer.
Oh, excellent.
Turbo wrap, turbo blanket.
Wow, you've got the works. Congratulations. So what we'll watch for is we'll wait and see. On an N14... if this soot comes down on its own, and sometimes it does, we'll just leave it alone. If it stays where it is or goes a little higher over the next, say, somewhere between 75 and 100,000 total miles on the in-frame, then we usually recommend going in and resetting the overhead. So, but if we don't have to, we don't. You know, it's one of those things we used to do just at a certain time, but with an oil sample, we don't have to waste that. If we can look at the soot and it stays low enough, then we can just leave it alone. But again, that this engine is running really well. This was a good in frame. I can tell by the numbers. We do see some wear metals, a little bit of tin, a little bit of chrome, and a little bit of iron. That's to be expected on an in frame. So, and the numbers are low. If they were double what you have, I wouldn't be all that worried after an in frame. So this is a really good looking sample.
Okay. The other one question is, my fuel economy is, how long do you think it would take before it would come back up to what it was before the in-frame?
If everything's done right, you should see the fuel economy back within 50 to 75,000 miles. It's not like we're trying to break in an entire truck where everything is tight. The only thing we're really breaking in here is the engine, and it shouldn't take long.
Okay. It's not far off, but it's been down a little bit. And
keep in mind the time of year we're dealing with. Yeah, you know, winter blend fuels, colder temperatures, all those things that kind of kill us in the winter. So just factor that in when you're, if you have the ability to go back and look at your numbers last year at the same time, sometimes that's a better comparison.
That's a little hard since I bought this truck with the idea that it already had rebuilt the engine, but he had already
got
oil, so there was no way to do an oil analysis. So I bought the truck and started driving it. It ran great, except it was going through a gallon of oil every 800 miles.
Oh, my God. Can we go find that guy and take him out back and just beat some sense into him?
He's in Russia now, but anyway, I had to rebuild.
You better stay there, because people like that just kind of piss me off. Why do you have to lie about something, you know?
Yeah. So anyway, outside of that, the truck's been it's doing what it said it would do, and it's I went from an EGR engine to a pre-EGR engine and moved back.
With what you've got on this engine and the fact that it's a pre-EGR, it's an N14, you are going to love this engine. Once you get them right, they are bulletproof. You don't spend a lot of time working on them. We think there's a huge potential for fuel economy there, and we're starting to focus a little more on the N14. So congratulations. You're going to be very happy with this one. Let's go to Mississippi. Sean, welcome to the program.
Howdy, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm in a lease right now with the intentions of not buying the truck. Actually, I don't want an emissions truck. It's more of a statement, not so much a question. I come into the industry in January. I started the lease the end of April, and I've been running ever since then as a lease operator. And I've been listening to your show almost religiously.
Thank you.
And I saw a pre-emissions Kenworth T600 the other day for sale in the state I live in, and he wanted $8,000 for it. It was a 1987 with a 3406B cat and a 15 speed.
I would skip that one. And there's one big reason. I was loving this truck. Now, 87. Okay, 87. It's absolutely a B. I have said many, many times, I love pre-emission trucks, but I don't ever want to go back to a mechanical engine in a truck that I want to make money with. Now, if I were going to go build a show truck or something to pull an RV around with, then I would have fun going back to a mechanical engine. You know, it's kind of nostalgic, and they're super, super simple to work on. But there are some big downsides when you compare a mechanical engine to a fully electronic engine. Fuel economy is one of the biggest. The best driver in the world, and no matter how we modify them, you are going to give up a full mile per gallon to almost 2 full miles per gallon in potential fuel economy. The electronics was the biggest advancement in diesel engines in the history of the diesel engine, in my opinion. The thing is, they don't stay together nearly as long. When we were running mechanical engines, it was common to just roll in a set of rod and main bearings every 250 or 300,000 miles. And the reason was, without the electronic controls, you would get a lot of fuel dilution in the oil. And that would just attack the bearings, and we would end up replacing a lot of bearings. And they didn't, you know, going 1,000,000 miles was way more difficult on a mechanical engine. So to me, there's just not enough upside in having that simple, easy to work on engine when the electronics was such a huge improvement in fuel economy, maintenance, power. That's the other thing. You know, getting 600 horsepower out of a mechanical engine really would kill your fuel economy, because about all you could do was make everything bigger, bigger fuel injectors. It was all mechanical. On an electronic engine, we can crank 700 horsepower out of a Series 60 that was 400 at the factory, and we do it all electronically. We don't have to put in bigger injectors or anything. So I love the T600, and I love the price. I just would not recommend a mechanical engine.
Okay, I got you. My intent by this time next year, I'll be 23 and old enough to lease on the Landstar, and my intentions are to have my own truck and trailer by then, because
excellent.
I've saved quite a lot of money in just the 8 months that I've been a lease op, because I have no bills, theoretically.
Well, that's outstanding. I mean, you are doing a great job of this, and you've got a good plan. You're looking at the right trucks, and I'm glad you asked, because that is a big deal. Once you start looking, if you're looking at a Detroit, you can look in the early 90s. If you're looking at a Cat or a Cummins, I would start looking at mid-90s and newer. But I wouldn't mind a 92 truck if it had a Series 60 in it, a 95 or a 96 if it had an electronic Cummins or a Cat. Anything older than that, though, and we're going to start running into some other problems. The music's playing. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, we're going to set up here and do a second hour. Let me check on the questions real quick and see if we've got any room for more. Looks like we should be pretty good. If I think I have some more room when we get into the show, I'll let you know. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. We'll talk about it here on the air, and I'll do my best to get you an answer. I'll even try to make it a good answer. Can't always guarantee it's going to be the right answer, but I'll try. We're going to get to those calls and questions and answers here in just a minute. I want to bring up a topic just because there seem to be a lot of people bringing up the other side of this topic, and I see it really being pushed hard in the trucking industry this year, more so than I think I've seen in the past. And that is the topic of flu vaccines. It's that time of year again, and everywhere I turn, there seems to be some sort of pushy message about how important it is to get the flu vaccine. They use a lot of scare tactics. And there is a lot of money behind this message. There are government subsidies. There are government programs. There are industry subsidies. There are big pharmaceutical companies. There are clinics. Everybody makes money off the flu vaccine. Now, I'm not against companies making money, but I also don't want to spend money, or even if they give it to me free, I don't want one. I never want one. And there are a lot of reasons. I'm not going to try to convince you one way or the other. All I want to do is at least make you aware that there is another side to this story. And just go do a little reading before you make that decision. I hear it being pushed in the trucking industry, even on some of the other shows, and I know they're well-intentioned. I'm not criticizing them for putting out the message, but it doesn't seem to be a very balanced message. And again, I know why. There's a lot of money pushing to get people to take a flu vaccine. The other side, I put a post up on Facebook. If you want to start there, you can certainly start there. It's on my page on Facebook. I'm not really on Facebook anymore, so don't, you know, send me a question or get upset if I don't respond to your comments. But I do realize there are a lot of people on Facebook, and it is a good place to put information out. So I have software that when I'm reading something I really like on the internet, I just click a button, it gets shared to Facebook. So it is a place for me to put things up. If you want to start there, you can. It was a very well-written article by a doctor. But there's lots of information giving the other side of the story. The problem is there's no money in the other side of the story. If I were to go out and start a big campaign to try to convince you not to get a flu vaccine, nobody's going to pay me. There's no way for me to make any money. And if I really wanted to get the message out, I would have to spend money to do it. It's never going to happen. That's why so many of these health issues get so lopsided, because all you have to do is follow the money and realize that all the messages you are getting paid for, TV commercials, magazine ads, Facebook posts that are really right there up front all the time, those are being paid for. The blog posts many times that look like they're coming from an independent source, news articles everywhere, they are all bought and paid for and influenced by companies that stand to make money from, in this case, the flu vaccine. In other cases, it's the food choices you make. There's lots of money pushing certain things, and the things that are really good for you, there's no way to make any money off of them. So you don't get those messages. I want to be I'd like to say the voice of reason, but at least the voice on the other side of the story, getting you to think a little bit. You know, just go do a little research before you decide to get a flu vaccine. Within 15 minutes of posting it, I probably had 20 messages telling me that the last time they had the flu was the year they got the flu vaccine, and they've never gotten another vaccine since, and they haven't been sick. Another statistic to think about. First off, if you're not aware, there are hundreds of sub-strains of the flu. There's really three main strains, A, B, and C. But there are hundreds of sub-strains, mutations. They're more and more every year. And the vaccine you're taking is only for one or two, maybe three. I don't know exactly how many they can cram into one vaccine, but it's not many. So what are your odds that the vaccine you get is actually going to target the one that you end up being exposed to? There's a lot of research saying that if you get vaccinated for this strain, it might protect you from that strain, but it will make you more susceptible to the other strains. And maybe that's why people get the shot and end up getting the flu more often. But nobody's ever going to tell you that. The statistic for last year, and even the medical community can't argue this one, it's documented, last year's vaccine was only 18% effective. That means for every 100 people that got the vaccine, only 18 saw any benefit. Those are horrible odds, especially when there are downsides for the other 82 people. Those aren't good odds. Again, I said I wasn't going to try to convince you, but now I'm trying to convince you. I'll leave it at that. You go do the research, and then you make up your own mind what you want to do this year. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's head off to Nebraska to get started. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Say, I've been on a ketogenic diet since last June. Of course, over Thanksgiving, I wasn't on it at all. But I forgot to turn my scale back. I gained 10 pounds. I usually have like a summer sausage and stuff, and I usually just read the nutritional deal, and it said I look for no carbohydrates and no sugars. Well, I went on, I got my summer sausage at a local grocery store, and it said zero carbohydrates and zero sugars. Well, when I went to read what was the ingredients in it, it had some kind of a dextrose corn syrup or something like that in it. So
right.
Wouldn't that be a sugar?
Dextrose is pure sugar. Dextrose is another name for glucose, and glucose is about half of table sugar. Table sugar is basically half glucose, half fructose. And it can be called sucrose, it could be called dextrose, it's got a bunch of different names. Interesting, though, and I've tried to research this to figure out why. They don't use much. It's in almost all sausage, unless you can find a really, really clean manufacturer, somebody that's doing grass-fed and really watching what they put into it. You're almost always going to get dextrose and some of those other things in processed sausages, but it's virtually no sugar to your body. There's no calories. And the other thing, honestly, probably the easiest form of sugar on your body is pure glucose. It's the fructose we want to be a little more careful about. So a little bit of dextrose in a summer sausage, I'm not going to get too concerned about it.
But why wouldn't it be marked as a sugar if it is a sweetener of some type?
The food labeling has some weird guidelines, and I could go through a whole list of them. This is one of them. It's the same thing with trans fats. You know, now that they're required to label trans fats, if the product has less than, I think it's 0.9 grams, they're allowed to show zero. So there are some tolerances and limits that they're allowed to get around. Some of them are weird. Some of them are. But again, it's not a big deal here. And one of the ways you could tell, eat the whole stick. Wait 2 hours and go check your blood sugar. You're not going to see a bump at all in your blood sugar. There's nothing in that food that's going to really have any effect. So I don't agree with the labeling, but I'm not going to get too worried about that one either. I'm going to come back to you right after the break. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Cuthbert. Back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to Nebraska. I was talking with Gary. So, Gary, it is kind of screwy. A lot of the things on food labels are. I wouldn't worry too much about that one. Another interesting one is when we see flavorings. They only need to be listed as either natural flavorings or artificial flavorings, and they don't have to list any further than that. That one word in there could mean you have 37 chemicals in the food. It's insane that they're allowed to get away with that. But then it goes even further. Natural and artificial, you might as well just throw it out. It's meaningless. It has nothing to do with whether the compound or the chemical was natural or artificial. It has to do with how it's processed. And when you read the rules, they are the screwiest things I've ever seen. They make no sense whatsoever.
Yep. And also, you know, I was able to lose 20 pounds doing this, you know, and just stayed there. Never had a problem. I do my bulletproof coffee, which I put like 2 tablespoons of the virgin coconut oil and 1 tablespoon of butter, organic butter. And that's what I have, and I put a little bit of whipping cream in it, like organic whipping cream, like roughly
Excellent.
A tablespoon just for flavoring it. And it carries me all the way, some days it carries me till 10:30 in the morning, sometimes it carries me till 3 in the afternoon, just depends on the day.
Yeah.
And then when I'm ready to eat some, I just have 1 piece of that lunch meat, which the sausage, summer sausage. 1 piece of like Kobe cheese, and I'll use my bread as 2 pieces of romaine lettuce, and I'll smear some butter on it, and that's what I'll eat.
Excellent. Well, and this is good timing for this topic, so let me address it real quick, because I kind of did the same thing over Thanksgiving. It's a holiday. Let's have some fun. Lisa made some amazing, actually, they were very, paleo-friendly pies, so there were no grains. She made this killer nut crust out of pecans. She did a pumpkin chiffon and a cheesecake, and they were amazing. So I ate a couple too many pieces of those and, the typical food. Now, I was definitely off keto, but we still ate pretty healthy. It was more of a paleo where, all whole food. We made everything from scratch. We had a lot of fun with it. But I gained... It didn't happen right away, but I realized that just actually last night that I had knocked myself out of ketosis, and over the next couple of days, I ended up gaining about 5 pounds. But I know what it is, and I'll explain it so people don't panic because I've already lost it. When you load your body up with those carbohydrates again, no matter how healthy they were, your body stores the carbohydrates as glycogen. For every molecule of glycogen it stores a molecule of three or four molecules of water along with it. So it's easy to gain 4 or 5 or 10 pounds in just a couple of days of too many carbohydrates. But it's mostly water weight. I mean, it's clearly not calories and fat. It would be impossible to gain that much weight that fast. It's water. So within just a couple days of getting back on a good ketogenic diet, I realized I'm peeing a lot again, and my body's just getting rid of that excess water that it was holding on to. So don't worry about the you know, little bit of weight gain there in the holidays. I expect it's going to happen a couple more times, but no big deal. Try sticking to good, whole, real food, and enjoy yourself at the holidays and have fun with it, and then get right back to a good keto diet, and you'll be fine. Let's go to Washington. Troy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, first time caller, and just new to the program. Just started listening about 2 weeks ago to you. The reason The reason I started listening is I've been doing some research. I want to become an owner operator. I've got a friend that's been doing it for quite a few years now, and he's offered to let me run under his authority. Some of these are pretty big words and new words to me. So I imagine after I purchase your program that a lot of these questions I have will be answered right within. But first things first, I've got four trucks on the line, and they all originally were Detroits that I was looking at. And after listening to your program, I heard some concerns about Detroit parts. And I'm probably going to answer my own question with the fact that, correct me if I'm wrong, but during an end frame, we would reuse the parts that are in the vehicle unless we melted something down. Is that not correct?
That's somewhat correct. But on an end frame, the whole point is replacing the parts that need replaced. And it's not clear what that's going to be until we take things apart. Do we want to rebuild the head? Will we use a new cam? Will we use, you know, a lot of times definitely new injectors? So we're finding two problems with the Detroit. And I have been a huge fan of the Series 60 Detroit for 25 years. I've owned more of them than I can count. I had always said that was my first choice in engines. And I stuck with that. I was comfortable with it. I knew the engine. It was hard to beat. Fuel economy is excellent. Maintenance costs are low. They last forever. They're easy to rebuild. But when we started running into some of these problems, there are two different problems we're seeing. The replacement parts we can get, injectors, you know, all kinds of things, the quality seems bad. We don't seem to have the same quality of parts we used to get. But an even bigger problem, and it took us a long time to figure this out, I started getting reports of engines that were just rebuilt and their fuel economy was horrible. Or gliders being built with these rebuilt engines and their fuel economy was in the fives. And I tell people all the time, you bring me a pre-emission engine with a fuel mileage problem and I'll figure it out. And we had a couple, and we couldn't figure them out. I tried everything. We sent them over to Pittsburgh Power. They couldn't figure it out. One of our other team members here, Jeff Zarley, who's just an excellent mechanic, kind of tracked down what the problem was. No matter what engine it is, whether it's a Cat or a Detroit or whatever, there are different versions of that engine. Some are built for on-highway. Some are built for marine. Some are built for industrial. And they can have different parts, but they look so similar you don't know it. And we found some of these engines were being rebuilt with the wrong parts. The engine will run. There's no apparent problem, but we couldn't ever get them tuned right. We couldn't get the overhead set right. We couldn't get fuel economy out of them. So those are two problems we saw in the supply chain because the Series 60 is so popular. And that problem really doesn't exist with the N14.
Yeah. Just because of the availability of the parts on the shelf. And
virtually 90-plus percent of the glider kits that are being built in the country, and it's a lot now and it grows every year, everybody uses Series 60s. It is by far the most popular engine in a glider. People are buying olds and rebuilding them, so a lot of Series 60s in those trucks. And we're just running into supply issues. So we just started leaning more towards the CAT, the 6NZ CAT, another great engine, and we don't see the supply problems with that. And the N14, that engine almost got forgotten. You know, people were building gliders with CATs. Hardly anybody was building gliders with N14s.
I hope to build a glider one day, but I think I'll be starting out with a 98 Volvo, or I've also been looking at a 99 FLC 112 and a Century 120. Both the Volvos I'm looking at, one has a N14 in it, and the other one has a Detroit. Of course, they're high-mileage rigs.
Let me give you a piece of advice. Looking at the older trucks, I mean, you wouldn't go wrong with any of those. I mean, you're not going to spend a lot of money on them. You'll get your money back. The Volvos hold up much better. You know, a late model Freightliner, Century, or Columbia, they fall apart. The cabs and the dashes just weren't built that well. Whereas the Volvo, I've got a 99 Volvo now, and I've had a bunch of 90 Volvos. They hold up really, really well. The dash looks like new at a million miles, even if somebody didn't take care of it.
So the quick question on that is the availability of parts, Freightliner versus Volvo. I've been told that the Volvos are a little harder to get a hold of, an airbag. You might be sitting on the road for a day or something for a part for that. Freightliner's availability.
That's true. Yep, that is true, but I've dealt with that for years. I bought brand new Volvos, bought old Volvos, kept Volvos. Parts are a little harder to find, but I just don't replace that many parts anyway. So to me, the quality, the ride, the noise level, something I deal with every day was more important. We'll be right back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking with Troy in Washington. I want to go back and wrap up that call. So, Troy, that is a true statement. Volvos have their supply chain can be a little frustrating. Freightliners are more common. Their parts are easier to find. But just to give you some history, I ran Volvos for years, and I would say that there would be two or three times a year that I would wait a day or two to get a part. And it was frustrating when it happened, but when I stack that up against I'm in the truck 250 days a year, and I want the better truck, I'll put up with the supply chain problem a couple times.
Right. Yeah, I was a commercial fisherman for a lot of years and been a chemical operator the last 7 years, so this is all extremely new to me. The other question I had was, being an owner-operator working under his authority, it'd probably be smart of me to establish an LLC to protect myself from being sued in case of an accident personally, or...
Nope.
And I hear this...
Nope.
No? No?
Don't even worry about it. Let me give you a quick... I could talk about this topic for about an hour, but let's cut right to the chase. First off, he has the authority, which means he will have the liability insurance, which really means he's taking on the liability. Being leased to him isn't all that different from being leased to, say, Swift. They're bigger, they have deeper pockets, but it's still the same relationship. He has the liability insurance. You are running under that insurance. He's as likely to get sued, more likely than you are. We're really, the thing that really decides this is, let me just ask you the question, and I probably already know the answer. Do you have a $1 million or more in easily obtained assets just sitting around?
negative.
Nobody's going to sue you. Attorneys today do not want to go through that unless they've got $1 million they can grab pretty easily.
Unless they can collect.
And it's, what's the point? I mean, why sue you? Because the attorney only gets paid most of the time on money that gets collected. So you can't even get an attorney to take these kind of suits unless they know they can get $1 million out of them, because they're hard to win. And they're time-consuming and they're expensive. And so that's the biggest reason. But here's another one. Let's say you did have the money. There'd be easier ways to safeguard it with some good financial planning. But just because you were incorporated does not mean you can't be sued. If there's enough money there, the attorneys are going to sue the carrier you're leased to. They're going to sue your corporation, which owns the truck, if we set it up right. But who was holding the steering wheel? That doesn't mean you can't be sued as a driver. If you work for Swift, you could be sued as a driver. You're the one that caused the accident. They're going to sue everybody. If they can, they're going to sue the mechanic that worked on your brakes last week.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, and then I hear this word escort as opposed to owner-operator. Are you talking escort vehicles, or is that another class of leasing vehicle or driving?
Now that truly is what it the word means. Those are the cars, vans, pickup trucks that you see with the wide load, you know, and the height stick, and they're escorting the oversized loads.
Right. Well, I hope that I can get your audio in the mail here shortly and get a little more information on this, so that I plan on making this jump pretty soon, and I'm really relying on my friend's knowledge to help keep me rolling. I know that he can keep me rolling, but to keep me moving forward in all aspects.
You'll find that there are a lot of similarities. You are a commercial fisherman. There really are a lot of similarities between the two. You have some new terms to learn and some things about freight rates and lanes and that kind of stuff, but it'll come. You've got a good background for this. You know, the program, when you get it, is going to answer a lot of your questions. Hopefully, it's going to give you a lot more. It's going to give you really good questions. When we have them, call me. That's what we're here for. Let's head off to Kentucky. Ken, welcome to the program.
Kevin, thanks for taking my call. I had a question regarding a reduction in freight rates. I was getting $1.56 for all miles on dedicated run. Carrier cut the rate to $1.30, and my costs are 63.5 cents per mile for the rate, you know, for my costs right now, and you know, it's looking to see what's on the other side of the fence, or just running with what I got.
Now, your 63 cents a mile cost, do you have a breakdown on that?
Yeah, 12.5 cents for fixed, 22 for fuel. I'm getting 9.53 miles a gallon, and my average cost of fuel is $2.08 per gallon of fuel. And then 29 cents for everything else, maintenance, office supplies, washes, scales, all that.
Got it. Okay, good. So, you know, the drop in rate is part of what's going on in the industry, and there are two things driving it: cheap fuel prices, whether we have a fuel surcharge specifically in the rate or not, fuel prices always affect rates. So you've got a really good fuel cost, so you're not getting, because your fuel cost is so low. Your cost of operation obviously is low enough that you're still making, what, about 67 cents a mile net? Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
That's not horrible. Could you do better? It's possible. I still have some guys making $1.50, $1.60 a mile. You know, places like Landstar have still managed to do really well. But they've dropped. It's just they started in the $2 range. So their drop, you know, left them at $1.60, $1.70. Sometimes I'm still seeing. So you could do better, but there's another factor to think about. Rates are still coming down. I just read an article this morning that there are places where gas is approaching $1.50 a gallon, and they are predicting we could see $1 a gallon. OPEC has said they are not going to cut production, and we have so much crude oil, we're running out of places in the world to store it. I don't ever remember seeing anything like this. The only reason I can think of is OPEC was being threatened by other countries who were really starting to push oil exploration and production. Russia has more oil than the rest of the world, just about. It's hard to get to. We were producing oil, the Canadian oil sands, and I think OPEC is just going to starve everybody out. They're just going to drop prices so low by overproducing that they're going to drive everybody else out for a while. That's all I can figure. So if we see $1 a gallon gas, who knows where diesel's going to go? Rates are going to continue to drop, and we're just going to have to deal with that. When you make a change as an owner-operator, when you change carriers, if you really do the math, you will lose about $10,000 a change. When you look at the time lost, the expense of moving, the lost revenue, and then how long it takes you to get back up to speed in a new operation, and once in a while, even if you do a lot of hard work, you pick an operation that you don't like. It turns out to be not what you thought it was going to be. You have a personality conflict with somebody. You don't like the freight or the customers. Now we've got a $10,000 loss. We've got to go do it again. So I'm not a big fan of jumping ship. I would, but I'm also not telling you you never move. It just needs to be more thought through than most people ever put into it. So your numbers aren't horrible. They're happening all over the place. Yes, there are places you could go and make more money, but you've got to weigh that against we're still seeing rates drop, and there's going to be a loss when you do it. So the other thing I try to convince people of, even if you've done all the hard work, even if you absolutely know you want to move to another carrier, don't do it if you're in not a good, solid financial position. You know, it might be the best move in the world, but if you do it at the wrong time because you're short on cash and your cash flow isn't looking that great, that could be enough to put you out of business. So think it through. Your net revenue of 67 cents a mile is not horrible. Just make sure you're thinking through all the issues before you decide what to do here. I'm going to get to a break. We're going to come back and take more of your calls and questions. Stick around. Kevin Roth. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. We'll see how many we can knock out before we've got to get out of here. Let's go to Michigan. Pete, welcome to the program. Pete, are you with me? Oh, we just lost Pete. I heard him there, but it looks like we lost him. So a couple things I want to remind you about. I talked about this on another show, but I've got a project I'm working on, and I need your help. I'm almost done with the project. We haven't really talked about it up until now. It is a free ebook. Now, I hate to say free because people devalue it. They think, oh, it can't be worth much. It's a very valuable ebook if you have ever thought about becoming an owner-operator. I outline the top 6 mistakes I see people make, and you're not going to know what they are. You will probably be surprised. You might be able to pick 1 or 2, but you're going to be surprised what they are. But these are the real mistakes that people make when they try to become owner-operators. The book is written. It's being edited, so my part of the writing is done. That's always the hard part for me. Brittany here from our Let's Truck team is editing that, and we're going to be releasing it pretty quickly, hopefully before the end of the year. We have some technical things to get done. I'm also going to record this as an audio book, and we're going to make the audio available free as well. This is my way of giving back this year, and I want to help people avoid making all these mistakes. If you are thinking about a lease purchase program, you need this program. Now, here's what I want from you. I want lease, purchase, and startup horror stories. Tell me what went wrong when you tried to become an owner-operator, whether it was buying a truck or signing a lease purchase or a third-party lease, whatever it was. Write me your horror stories. Don't worry about the punctuation or the grammar or the spelling. We'll fix all that. Just get your story down in writing and get it over to us. I'm going to give you an email address to send it to, so grab something to write with. If we choose your story, I'm going to choose 5 or 6. If we choose your story to be part of the ebook, I'm going to give you 2 things. I'm going to give you a free pre-trip tool, very cool little tool that goes on your keychain and measures some things for you during a pre-trip. And I will give you credit as one of the contributing writers. So, and you'll have the satisfaction of helping me give back to the industry. Get your stories down. I'm looking for roughly 500 to 1,000 words. If it's shorter, longer, that's fine. Get them down and send them to support@letstruck.com. support@letstruck.com. And get it done pretty quick because we're going to wrap this project up and get it out to people so they can start using it for some planning for next year. Let's get to the phones. Let's go to Florida. Marty, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I've got a question for you. I was looking at a 97 W900 with an N14, 13 speed, and I'm trying to figure out what kind of fuel mileage now the truck is supposed to have 250,000 on a rebuild, got 1 million on the chassis.
There's a couple things here that concern me. In fact, I'll just tell you right out, this would not be a truck I would buy. 2 reasons. One, if I have the choice, I'm never going to buy a classic because I lose a full mile per gallon in potential. No matter what we do to that truck, we can get it to the very best fuel economy possible. But if we had the exact same setup in a T600 instead of a W9, we could get a full mile per gallon more. When we go back to normal fuel prices between $3 and $4 a gallon, that's $1,000 a year. If I own the truck for 3 years, that's $30,000 just because of the body style. There's no other real difference in the truck. In fact, the cab is smaller than a lot of other models. So I would skip it for that reason alone. There's another reason, though. I'm wondering what went wrong that they had to do an in-frame on an N14 at 750,000 miles. That's a 1.5 million mile engine. I know a couple of them that are approaching 2 million miles that haven't been rebuilt yet. So something went wrong. Either it was a lousy build originally, it wasn't taken care of. That worries me. because does that mean I'm also going to start losing other major components early? Who did the in-frame on this? Do we have any paperwork?
No. From what I understand, if it had a $250,000 in-frame or something, but the truck has been sitting for 2.5 years, and people have just been stealing parts off of it.
That doesn't worry me so much. That trucks that sit, that scare some people, it really doesn't me. That those are all easy problems to overcome. The other problems I outlined aren't easy to overcome. The aerodynamics, forget it. You're never going to overcome that problem. And why this thing was rebuilt so early, those are two major strikes for me. I would only need one of those to pass this truck up.
All right. Okay, well, I'm looking at something trying to get me that's cheap to get me out of a lease purchase.
No, I love that. How much is this truck?
$6,000.
Yeah, I can find $10,000 trucks that would be way better. I've seen $4,000 trucks that I would pick over this. They're hard to find, no question, but if they gave me this truck, I would turn around and sell it for $5,000 so I had money to go buy something else. I wouldn't even put it on the road if they gave it to me. So there isn't a price good enough for me to want to put this truck on the road. There are other options out there, and I would hate to see you get it. I had a caller, I don't remember if it was this show or last night, bought one of these. I think he paid $7,000 or $8,000 for his truck. Guy swore it had an in-frame, and it didn't. There was no paperwork. It doesn't sound like there's documentation on this one. And they just lied. I mean, the engine was just flat wore out when he got it, and he had to do an in-frame almost immediately. You know, something like that happens, or if we don't have documentation, this in-frame could have been done under a tree in somebody's backyard. And you might just be, when we buy $5,000 to $10,000 trucks, I know we're buying maintenance problems. I get that, but they're problems we can solve, and we do everything we can to stay away from the biggest problems. And I'm just seeing big problems with this one.
Okay. All right. Well, I got another question. On that bulletproof coffee. What's the difference between XCT oil, MCT oil, or coconut oil?
Okay, good question, and I'll cut to the chase because we're running out of time. Skip the XCT and the MCT. Those are what are called fractionated oils. They've processed them down to get to the pure MCT, which is where we get the energy from. I'm just not a big fan of processed foods. I actually tried MCT oil for an entire month, didn't really notice any difference. It's more expensive. It is a highly refined or a higher refined version of coconut oil. To get down, pure coconut oil is about 50-some percent MCT, and they refine these down to where they're 90-some percent. I didn't see a difference in energy or fullness or anything else. Because I didn't see a difference, I would rather go back to the natural version of the oil, as close to the whole real food as possible, and that's what I would recommend. Stick with a good virgin coconut oil, and you should be just fine. I am looking at the clock, and I am all out of time here. I'm going to have to wrap this up, and we will see you back here next time. Check out the website. It is letstruck.com. Check out the store while you're there. We've got lots of new stuff, cool stuff in the store. We're always adding to it. We've got some great specials going on right now. But more important than the specials, this is stuff you want. This is stuff you're going to invest in, not spend on. Because it's going to give you a return on your money and make your operation better. Check it out. Check out our software and our tax and accounting while you're there as well. It's letstruck.com/store.
or you can give us a call, 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3835. Thanks for joining me. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Ruff. All right, a couple things real quick. I'm going to take one more call because it's a level four oil sample. I'm going to take it off the air. We're not recording right now. And then I have, you know what, I'm going to make the announcement first. So if you don't want to listen to this last call, you can go. Tomorrow at 12 o'clock Eastern time, we will send out a text message, but we are going to be doing a special three-hour recording with Bruce Mallinson from Pittsburgh Power and his mechanics and his electrical engineers. We're going to cover all kinds of topics, but more important, we're going to take your engine and electronic related calls. It will be this phone number, same number you called in today, but it will be an hour earlier, 12 o'clock Eastern time, and we will run for a full three-hour show. And we're going to use that show on a weekend coming up here soon because I have a weekend of classes I have to attend. So join us for that tomorrow. We will send out a text message, though, as well. All right, let's I'm going to go to Eddie. Eddie, I guess we're looking at an oil sample here.
Yes, sir.
Okay. 1.1 million on the engine and about 50,000 on the oil. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. Wow. You've got some odd readings here, and I'm not sure why. If we go back to when this oil was brand new, I'm looking a couple samples back in July. You immediately, the base dropped way off and the oxidation went way up. But there doesn't seem to be any apparent reason why. There's no fuel dilution to worry about. Soot is extremely low. There's no water. We're not getting any sodium or potassium in here. There's nothing that should cause that base to drop off like that and that high of oxidation. I'm almost thinking that you just got some really old oil. There's nothing in here that worries me. The condition of the oil is not great, but there's nothing in your engine that seems to be causing. I think all I would do just now, just to clear this up and give us a little peace of mind, that was just would change the oil and resample at your normal schedule, and let's see what happens next time.
Because what I was thinking about doing was converting, because I have a dual canister PS system, and it's an old system. So I was thinking of converting over to the single EcoPure, because I'm not sure if that might be my problem, that the one that eliminates the liquid contaminants.
Yeah, it's possible. I would, you know, the OPS, I had one that lasted a very, very long time, the old style. And if it is still working, I would hate to see you go out and spend the money to get a new one. I would try one oil change. If this comes back and we can't explain it, then maybe so. But like I say, this showed up before you even had 20,000 miles on the oil. If you didn't have a bypass system at all, I would have thought that was unusual.
Yeah, and it just showed up immediately, and it stayed there. Everything
seems
to be good, just that.
That's why I almost think it was just old oil. Somebody had something sitting. Did this come out of jugs or out of a pump system?
Out of jugs.
Yeah, maybe something got stuck in a warehouse, and it was just old stock. It's just a little odd. And rather than have you run out and spend money on a new EcoPure, which is a great system, but you already have a good system,
I would do one oil change. Check your next sample. Give me a call, and we'll see if we can figure it out. Uh-oh.
Hello?
I'm losing you.
Yeah, I'm losing signal. But, I'll try that. I'll change my oil before converting over to the EcoPure, see if that changes anything. If not, I'm going to try the EcoPure. Because, you know, that might be my problem.
Yeah, it
okay.
could be.
Well,
and, you know, now's a good time. They're running some specials. But, I think your old-style filter is doing just fine. Like I say, that if I would have saw the first oil sample and somebody didn't have a bypass at all, I would have thought it was on. So give that a try. Give me a call back, and we'll go from there. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Join us. You're going to have lots of opportunity to ask questions of the engine experts tomorrow from Pittsburgh Power. We'll see you then.